Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Star Family Wisdom podcast. I'm Jenna Layden, your host. I'm also the founder of Star Family Wisdom and a former global vice president for Whole Foods Market, turned spiritual cosmic guide, shaman, all things universal we are exploring over here at Star Family Wisdom. And if you've been following along, you are familiar with the fact that I've been journeying to India this year and taking some time off here and there to focus on some really advanced yogic processes and spiritual practices. And these spiritual practices are really important ones because these are practices that were utilized by Jesus, by Yeshua, by his masters and many masters who came before us. Many people have, you know, journeyed to India to find, connect with, practice, you know, ancient wisdom, knowledge, and these spiritual technologies. But what is really incredible about this set of spiritual technologies is that not all of these had been out in the open until recently. And these technologies were brought to the world by Saint Sri Kaleshwar in his lifetime. And Saint Sri Kaleshwar has his own interesting connection with Jesus. So you can back up, you know, and listen to some of the previous episodes to learn a little bit more about that. You can go on our website and access a free webinar and lots of other resources related to this lineage if you're curious, you know, and want to explore more. But I'm preparing to go back to India for a third time. This is airing, I think, as I'm going to India. And I thought it might be fun for us to talk about a book that I stumbled upon recently. And the timing of this is really fascinating, considering this trajectory I've been on to not only learn about these practices and this wisdom, but embody it. And I've taken time off throughout the year as I've been journeying to India and doing these practices, because the transformation I've been experiencing is profound. And I'm excited to talk more about that as time goes on. As I get back from India, we'll be taking a little break from the podcast. So there'll be a few weeks where we are not together, but I will report back when I'm back and we'll see what wants to come through then. So today we're gonna talk about Helena Blavatsky's book, The Land of Gods. So again, I'm traveling to the land of the gods in the next few weeks. And this book is an account of her visit to Shambhala. I think a lot of people have heard of the idea of Agartha or Shambhala or the inner earth civilizations, or maybe the Great White Brotherhood and these, this group of masters, immortals who are guiding humanity. The lineage I'm studying under is connected to that group in a really powerful and specific way. I'll just leave it at that. And while I've been familiar with Helena Blavatsky, also known as Madame Blavatsky, I've been familiar with her work for a long time. I've read a lot of The Secret Doctrine, and I love her books, Isis Unveiled. There's some really incredible wisdom in those. This book I had not found yet, and this is a really beautifully written account of this journey she took to meet the masters of light and to visit Shambhala. So we're going to talk about that today. And in the story, we learn more about the masters of wisdom in Shambhala and the Great White Brotherhood and humanity's seven teachers. There are a lot of names and phrases that have been used to describe these immortal beings of light who have sometimes incarnated, sometimes interacted with humanity to share their wisdom and guide humanity to a higher path. So in this book, a lot of their wisdom is revealed and reflected upon as she engages with them. And for those who aren't familiar with Shambhala, This is described as a hidden city, a hidden abode of light, an ashram or monastery of the great brotherhood of these teachers of humanity that is hidden to the uninitiated, and even the initiated don't always get access. It is a very, very rare occurrence that someone who is still, you know, embodying this human form in this modern civilization may get access. So, you know, she lived in, I think, the late 1800s, early 1900s. I'm not remembering exactly. But suffice to say, she, you know, is not part of this modern civilization. She came, you know, a couple of generations before us. And the wisdom and information she connected with in her lifetime, which was guided by her mediumship, you know, she was a powerful medium connecting with the other side, connecting with beings of light, and they guided her. So in this book, it starts in the Alpine mountains of southern Bavaria, where she's spending some time, and she's investigating the Rosicrucian history. I think there's a lot of information out there about the Rosicrucians and the wisdom that has been held under that lineage. And she's studying this. She writes about some of that, you know, in The Secret Doctrine, which apparently came out after this experience occurred. So she goes out on an adventure while she's in southern Bavaria. She's in these beautiful, you know, Alpine mountains, and she decides she just needs a few days of holiday to get away from her studies. So she goes out on a little adventure, and she settles into this hotel, or what would have been an inn back then. And once she's settled in this is this beautiful scenery, she begins meandering along this gorgeous Alpine river and then up into the mountains. And she finds herself up in the mountains alone. And all of a sudden, she hears something, and she sees that a stranger is approaching. And the stranger is short, about 3 feet in height. And the stranger just says, "Master says I should guide you to his house." And she says, who is Master? And he says, "The Imperator." Now, she decides she'll follow along. You know, she doesn't know what's going on. And, you know, she's already familiar with the occult and mystical experiences. So, you know, if I were her, I'd be like, well, here's another one. Might as well just go with it. So she follows this guy, and she gets guided through a cave-like tunnel. And on the other side of this tunnel is a valley and another, you know, range of steeping Alpine mountains. And as she comes out of this tunnel, you know, it's almost as though she's passing from one reality to another, and all of nature around her is just getting more and more beautiful, and so it's appearing as though she's in a different land now, you know, similar to where she was in Bavaria, but a little different. And in the distance, up in the mountains, she notices some sort of palace or like monastery. And it becomes clear that this person is guiding her to this palace, this monastery. And as they get closer to the building, another man appears. And this is a person wearing long yellow robes. And she begins to think, ah, he must be an adept, a spiritual adept. And he answers her from reading her thoughts. And he explains that he's inviting her to meet the adepts, to meet the great brotherhood that she has been studying. And she recounts in this that she had been meditating on, you know, these great masters and had hoped to meet them in her lifetime. And so he says he will introduce her to, quote, the Brothers of the Golden and Rosy Cross. So knowing immediately that she was making the acquaintance of this important group of masters, she expresses a desire to stay with them. You know, she's been, you know, pulled into this spiritual world and this spiritual way of living, and, you know, no longer really feels aligned with the rest of the world. But from this point forward, she starts to engage in this really lengthy dialogue with the masters, and she learns about their transition from normal mortal bodies to their immortal bodies. And this person describes himself as the Imperator. And the Imperator explains that she cannot stay indefinitely because she has her own soul contract to fulfill. And he describes that she has, quote, too many of the lower and animal elements adhering to her constitution, forming part of herself, right? So this means she is still very much embodying the animal human nature, and she needs to be going through the process of alchemical transformation to shift and clear some of those more animal elements before she would maybe be able to stay indefinitely. So that's the process of ascension and transformation from an enlightenment standpoint that she would ultimately be engaging if she were being invited to stay. So, you know, she understands the occult mysteries in detail, and she's been a seeker of the mysteries. And even though she's taken this academic approach to understand the mysteries, you know, rather than engaging in the actual practices and, you know, processes and protocols that allow for the transformation of the material animal human form into a divine human form with supernatural abilities, you know, she's taken the more academic approach. So she's learning about alchemy in this dialogue with the masters, and she's learning about that process of transformation from the animal human form into the divine form. And in the first set of conversations, we learn about the will or intention and the primordial power of the will and how it can be wielded to give rise to physical reality and change physical reality. And we're learning, you know, that we're an instrument through which universal power can flow and act. This adept is talking to her about this and about the way in which will plays in that process of manifestation. And so we hear this conversation ensue about the difference between individual will and universal will, and learning about the universal will and force and divine plan that may be set in motion, and how if one aligns their personal will with the great universal will, we're able to become more powerful. And ultimately we transcend the limits of time and space when we align our personal will with the universal will. And you can only act powerfully if your will remains aligned with the will of the great universal power, universal mind, with God. When we start to come into the place of acting purely from our own will that's not in alignment with the greater divine plan or with the laws of the universe, we're going to lose some of our power. And the adept explains that when we start to imagine that our own will is becoming greater than the one universal power, that will ultimately bring about our destruction. They just lay this out plain and simple in how they describe it. And so the adept talks about giving yourself over to be guided by the divine will of the universe, because that is ultimately how we attain more power. It's kind of the paradox, right? And And this might be one of the most powerful statements made in this first conversation. The adept says, "Nature obeys those who act in obedience to her laws." So right there, we know we need to understand the spiritual laws of the universe, and we need to be living by them. Because when we obey those laws, then nature will obey us. And ultimately, the adept talks about how human intelligence should only be used to aspire to the higher universal intelligence and truth. And that's, you know, where things have gotten a little off track here on Earth at times. I'll pause here and show you my shirt, since we're talking about spiritual adepts and masters. Jesus was a yogi. This is my new controversial shirt that I'm super excited about. This is available on starfamilywisdommerch.com. We have a bunch of cool shirts and bottles and mugs and stuff with spiritual and cosmic designs. And so I'm testing this one to see how people respond, because I think it's just really cool to think about how, you know, Jesus went to the land of the gods to activate his powers, to learn about these mysteries and embody them. And then here we are reading about Helena Blavatsky's account with those same masters. So she then gets guided through this monastery and starts to see more of it. And she sees statues and photos adorning the walls, and the imperator articulates that the pictures she's seeing represent other monasteries or lamaseries of their order, of their spiritual order. And she immediately zones in on a photo of a lamaseri that was said to house the highest level adepts of their order. And he also explains that the photos and things that she's interacting with in this lamaseri have occult qualities and may reveal more information if perceived in the right way. And here my mind is immediately going to Harry Potter. For anyone who has seen Harry Potter and how like the pictures move, and you might see, you know, a story play out in the pictures when at first they appear, you know, to be stationary. This is the sort of like occult quality I'm envisioning as he's explaining this. And he goes on to explain mysterious clues about the spiritual and universal significance of the cross and the rose, these two symbols being divine symbols that can be used in certain ways on the path to adepthood. I think that's the right term. And adeptship, whatever. And so, you know, if you remember back, he introduced himself as one of the brothers of the golden and rosy cross. So here this order has, you know, incorporated the cross and the rose into their name. And this is something we've, you know, seen in the Rosicrucian histories as well. And he shares that no one can become a member of their order by only intellectually understanding certain concepts. He says that that's imaginary knowledge, that knowledge, wisdom has to be seen, understood, and felt through the entirety of our being. So there we're talking about this embodiment, true embodiment. And I've been reflecting on this a lot throughout this year, because I'm recognizing this difference between, you know, where I was previously with just this intellectual understanding of certain concepts about our universe and the mechanics of existence, to now having gone through some really powerful transformation processes and on like a deep cellular level, you know, feeling and knowing it. And so here she gets guided into a library with just an extraordinary array of books, and she's just blown over, because these books are books that were out of print at her time, no longer available, and maybe ones that had been destroyed in, you know, fires and that sort of thing. And they just recreate them by pulling contents from the astral plane. So they talked about how, because of their level of, you know, spiritual power and psychic abilities at that point, they can just reach into the Akashic records and find the book and recreate it. So, quick side note here about what we just talked about around embodiment and around this topic of the books. I accessed a past life memory, one of the first ones I accessed, of being in and around the Library of Alexandria. I was a messenger boy for the Library of Alexandria in that life. And in that life, I watched the library burn. And this was a trauma that was kind of programmed, you know, into my field, into my soul. And during that regression, or during the regression where we found that life, we explored the fact that I had developed this kind of somewhat unhealthy obsession with books as my spiritual awakening occurred. And as these past lives were being activated in my field, I was feeling this just intense like need and desire to save books. And when we did this regression, we found out, well, that stemmed from this trauma I had experienced where, you know, I just felt this incredible loss. And I recognized, you know, what had been lost, you know, what just a horrific incident that was for humanity to lose all of that wisdom. And in the regression, guidance came through from my higher self to help me heal from that and integrate. And the guidance was, quote, wisdom cannot be burned. And after that regression, I integrated that, and that kind of compulsion to buy books and save books started to you know, lessen. And then when I read this in this book about the library and this hidden monastery and how they pull the information from the Akashic records and recreate books and how wisdom cannot be burned, I felt that in my whole body. It was like a cellular level integration occurred as soon as I read that in this book. And I had this just massive tingling in my crown chakra. So this was a beautiful example of the multi-layered healing process that we go through, that I needed to read that in this book to really let that sink in. And to know, you know, to really know. And so she asks this spiritual adept about their powers, because clearly they are all powerful beings. And she asks about why they don't interfere in human affairs. And the adept acknowledges that their power is so great that they could control much of humanity if they wished, but they understand universal laws, and one of those is free will and one of those is karma, and so they don't. And so they, you know, talk about ways in which they can guide, ways in which they can offer wisdom, ways in which they might be able to plant seeds in maybe the collective consciousness of humanity, so that those who are ready, like Madame Blavatsky or maybe other scientists or people who are, you know, studying these things can pull that information and allow that to flow through them, so they can help in those sorts of ways. But just full-on interference is not something they should or, you know, want to do. They then go on to talk about the seed of our spiritual power and how that seed germinates and grows, and how for us to gain spiritual power and strength, resistance must be met. And I'm, you know, reflecting on this as I read this in relation to my own journey. And I think a lot of what we go through, where, especially as we say yes to evolution and we say yes to our growth, we will then get faced with major challenges or maybe even pushback from people. And that is for us to be able to practice holding our spiritual center, to stay in truth, to stay in non-judgment, to stay in acceptance and love. And that is a huge challenge in the face of some of that resistance, especially if we're still holding some of our own wounding, you know, that triggers us. So this caused me to really reflect on, wow, you know, what resistance have I faced that has really made me stronger through this journey? So this is an invitation for you to think about that resistance that you've faced and how you've grown stronger from that, and how we actually need that. You know, we just aren't going to become spiritually strong and resilient beings if we don't have those opportunities to practice, right? It makes sense when you think about it that way. So, you know, I think a lot of us, as we embark on the spiritual journey and go deeper on the spiritual journey, as we encounter those major challenges that may be karmic in nature or may just be these moments to give us practice and help us continue rising through that spiral of life, at first it can feel hard and difficult and defeating, and we have to remember that as those things are happening, this is for us to practice. We embarked on this journey because we wanted to become more spiritual, more powerful, more aligned, you know, more healed, and that's how we do it. He then goes on to talk about our modern civilization and how the main thing that we are feeding is our brain and intellectual activity. And I think a lot of us understand the more holistic spectrum of life now, and how this modern civilization has not necessarily helped us feed all aspects of that life that needs to be fed for us to be healthy. And he uses, the adept uses the term top heavy to describe how we have overfed our brains and ultimately underfed our hearts. And how, you know, through that process of just, you know, overemphasizing intellectual achievements, overemphasizing the, you know, intellectual study of the world around us, we've not allowed our hearts to lead or even develop and feel what is possible. And we've starved our spirits. So, you know, he talks about how the seat of our character is our heart, and we certainly, you know, in this civilization have not given ourselves ample time and space and opportunity to grow our character through our hearts. And so, you know, that caused me to reflect a lot on love and the mind, and how the mind pulls us out of love a lot, and how that is a huge challenge for us, especially as we are reprogramming ourselves to come back to a state of just being in love and living from the heart more than the mind. That's a hard switch to make when we've really lived mostly in our minds. And then the adept, you know, goes back to the resistance topic a bit, talking about how, you know, people should force themselves to stay in contact with the very things and situations and people that will provide resistance, and to stay in contact with the things that are not in alignment with their taste. And it doesn't mean we are, you know, immersing ourselves in that, but it means we're not running from it. It means we're staying in contact. You know, I have some of those situations in my life and my family where may not be my preference, you know, to stay totally in contact, or you know, their taste may not be my taste, but it is by staying in contact with that that we learn how to harmonize, and we learn how to stay in our harmony in any situation. And so as we do that, we grow stronger and we develop our spiritual strength through those sorts of experiences. And so here they start to shift gears a little bit and talk about how, you know, some spiritual adepts may want to kind of remove themselves from the world or live a really ascetic life, a simple life, a pure life. And how some people maybe attempt that too soon. And he talks about how, or he says, those who can't evolve a world within their soul need the world to evolve it. So in other words, you know, once we have grown powerful enough to fuel our own evolution, we need less of the world to help us with that. And he talks about how those who have met sufficient resistance to be in their spiritual strength could then retire from the world and no longer need it. But he also says that the true ascetic, you know, the true person with spiritual strength is the man or woman who lives in the world, surrounded by its temptations, not running from it. And someone who uses the power of their spiritual strength to rise above the animal self, to rise above those temptations that we find ourselves falling into. And then they start to talk about that attainment of spiritual power, not just spiritual power, but that attainment of enlightenment, which is the ability to live within the kingdom of heaven. And I've been thinking about that a lot, like, what does that mean? And as I've had more tastes of the kingdom of heaven, what does it mean to operate in that state fully? And the adept talks about how once someone has attained the kingdom of heaven within, they already know and embody all of the universal good that is available to them. So they really don't want much more. You know, they just focus on ways to do good for others. And so the conversation shifts to discussion about the development of our inner world versus that constant seeking and the distractions of the outer world, and how all that's just an illusion ultimately, and how, you know, our science has just overemphasized like identifying what makes up external objects. And we've just overemphasized, you know, examining and investigating all the external things of life rather than examining and developing our internal world. And the adept starts to talk about that internal world and how it gets reflected outside of us. And he uses the analogy of a mirror, and that our mind is like a mirror. And it reflects the ideas that are floating around in the universal mind. And he uses the analogy of a lake. If the lake's water is smooth and still, you can see the clouds passing by and they're perfectly reflected. And then if the lake's water becomes a little distorted or rippled, that reflection of that perfect sky becomes distorted and rippled. And then if the water becomes really muddy, then the reflection stops altogether and we can't see anything. So this is a beautiful example of how that connection with the divine mind works, the connection with our divine alignment, our guidance, our ability to tap into universal intelligence and see the divine plan reflected in our life. So, you know, I reflect here on all of the negative programming we take on as humans when we come into this world, that muddies the water, and we can't see the divine plan for our life. We can't see the divine reflections that are possible. So we've got to clear the water. You know, we've got to clear our mind and reprogram ourselves for the more beautiful possibilities so that those can be reflected back to us. And I love this point that the adept makes. He references our religions, and he talks about how, you know, many religions talk about the Holy Trinity, and he uses Christianity as an example, and he refers to the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The Father being will or intention, the Son being the thought or idea, and the creative power of the Father acting through the Son is the Holy Ghost. Right? So our will combines with thought to move the creative force of nature into the physical. And I love thinking about it that way, and this maybe reframing of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, because I think we have misunderstood those terms in a lot of ways, right? We have personified a God as a father, and we have talked about Jesus as his only son, and we've just created this narrative that prevents us from understanding what those three things, the Holy Trinity, really is. And so, you know, ultimately we can just think about that as the creative force that manifests. And the Adept talked about the practicality of spiritual power versus intellectual pursuits. And he uses the example of how one would actually fare better in life by pursuing the development of clairvoyance versus learning the habits and traits of monkeys. That was his example. And that most people don't have the inner strength or courage to break free from social conditioning and habits and maybe foolish uses of our time. And he talks about how, you know, what good is all this exhaustive labor, you know, of work that we're doing when it only contributes to the degradation of health and all these perpetuated misperceptions about how our reality actually functions. So the Adept here, you know, is steering us to lean into the development of our spiritual gifts and our spiritual sight, because when we are able to clear the water, develop that spiritual sight, develop our ability to reflect the divine possibilities into the physical, yeah, we don't have to question as much about what's going on in our physical world. We are naturally going to start to live a more beautiful, interesting life. and then we can, you know, study the traits of monkeys. So the Adept also references how every human being has immense power for good, and we just have to develop the right conditions for that to flourish. And he starts to talk about the clergy of our world and their desire to do good, and the example of how many orders, you know, maybe nuns, or, you know, even, you know, certain churches might support hospitals or food banks, and how that's beautiful and this wonderful act of service and doing good, but how many of those members of our clergy possess no actual higher spiritual powers, because they've not been trained in how to acquire those and how to grow those. And as I've examined this concept and understood more about the truth of spiritual power and the connection with God and what is possible, I too am concerned about the fact that many of our clergy members really aren't powerful bridges between the divine and earthly realms. You know, they have not trained and developed their spiritual gifts and faculties. You know, they might just discuss concepts that they have not yet fully embodied. It's beautiful to have a guide. It's beautiful to have people that can share words of wisdom. But as I've, you know, gone deeper on this path, it has become so important to me that I'm learning from people who embody that wisdom. And he, you know, he poses a question: do the religious orders as they are now fulfill their original purpose of raising people up to a higher and more spiritual state of existence? Or are they just centers where pious and benevolent people gather to do good works? It's a good question, and something that maybe we could reflect on, you know, in terms of what transformation is possible in our religions, and what level of study and spiritual practice we could reincorporate into our religious orders. He asks, you know, can the inhabitants of our convents exercise spiritual power, like curing the ill with the touch of their hands? Can they prophesy the future Do members of religious orders understand the spiritual science and mechanisms behind supernatural divine events when they happen? Are any of our clergy on earth spiritual adepts? That is a powerful question to ask ourselves. And you know, I think the most important question is, how can someone be a spiritual guide for others when they don't possess their own spiritual power yet? So, you know, I think it's a good moment for us all to reflect on who we follow. And again, words of wisdom might be shared, but do they hold any sort of spiritual power themselves? Have they done the work to transform into what they are preaching? I think those are great questions. And the book continues with Blavatsky having a conversation with a couple of female adepts, and one who starts to describe a past life in which she gained her immortality. And this was a life of a young girl who led an army with the guidance of angels and who got burned by a fire. So that story might sound familiar to you. And as this adept is describing this scenario, Blavatsky knows this was Joan of Arc. And the story, you know, this adept describes, talks about the soul of this young girl during the fire, leaving her body and then finding a new home with the spiritual adepts who were present at the burning that no one else could see because they were invisible to them. And through various processes, she was able to solidify a new body through which she was visible to Blavatsky. So Blavatsky is having this experience of meeting spiritual masters and great sages and what appear to be historical figures of the past who have attained their level of spiritual adepthood and now live in the great land of Shambhala. And now the book wraps up in an interesting way. You know, throughout the book, you're having these moments of, wow, is this really happening? And upon completion of this adventure, Blavatsky finds herself waking up under a tree. And all of a sudden she thinks, oh no, is this all a dream? Surely not. But then she remembers two gifts that the adepts gave her, which were to prove the very real nature of what happened. One of those gifts was a white lily flower that was said to maintain its physicality after she left Shambhala. Another was a book that the adept wanted to give her and said would be delivered to her room at the inn. So as she's waking from this experience and wondering if this was all just a dream, she looks down and she sees the white lily in her possession. And that of course makes her think, okay, what about the book? So she runs to the inn and the book that the adept had promised was waiting for her. And on the inside of the book was written this message, quote, "Friend, study this book practically. Bring the circle into a square. Mortify the metals, calcinate and purify them of all residua. When you have succeeded, we will meet again. I will be with you when you need me." I won't tell you what that book is, but you can still buy it today. So this is a call for you to embark on your own journey of finding those secrets, reading this book so that you find the clues to take that next step on your path. And I hope you read this and connect with the supernatural wisdom of these great adepts and saints and masters who are constantly guiding humanity. And it's said that every century, the Mahatmas, the Sapta Rishis, these seven masters of wisdom, prepare to admit two candidates into their abode of light, preparing them to hold the mysteries and teachings. And the primary consideration is to prepare the candidate's body, which requires 3 years of extensive preparation. And it is also said that before revealing the secret doctrine, which is maybe the work Blavatsky is most known for, she had undergone this 3 year period of grueling transformation within the body under the supervision of her adept teacher from Tibet. So with that, I will say goodbye for now as I journey to the land of the gods and spend some more time in India studying and embodying this wisdom. And I'm just excited for what comes next when I'm back, and excited to continue this journey with you and sharing about what's possible. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. Check out Star Family Wisdom merch. If you want a Jesus Was a Yogi shirt, we've got some others on there too. We've got some really cool UFO shirts and starseed merch as well. And as always, check out starfamilywisdom.com for any free resources or material that might be helpful for you in your journey. And leave a comment below if this resonated for you, if you're curious about any aspects of this wisdom that was revealed that we could maybe talk about more when I get back. And I hope you have a great October. I'll see you soon. Bye for now.